Welcome to Israel War Briefing, a podcast from the Jewish Chronicle offering deep insight into the crisis in the Jewish state as it continues to unfold. I'm Jake Wallace-Simons, editor of the Jewish Chronicle and author of Israelophobia, the newest version of the oldest hatred and what to do about it. In each episode, I'll be asking an expert commentator for their analysis of the latest developments and reflections on what comes next. This week, I'm joined by the Israeli philosopher and public intellectual Mika Goodman to discuss the minor matter of how to resolve the Israel-Palestine conflict, which we hope to sort out in the next hour or so. I think we can do that. In addition to being a best-selling author of titles including Catch 67, Mika's the co-presenter with lawyer and broadcaster Efrat Shapira Rosenberg of one of Israel's most popular podcasts, Miflegeta Machshavot, which has 3.5 million downloads and counting. Now, on Sunday the 10th of March at 12:30 p.m. in London, Mika and Efrat will be at Book Week, formerly Jewish Book Week, for a live recording in English of Miflegeta Machshavot, analysing the impact of the war on Israeli society. Tickets are available at jewishliteraryfoundation.co.uk. So, Mika, thank you so much for joining us. It's a real pleasure to have you here.
I'm glad to be here.
Mika, for people who might not be aware of your intellectual background or your big ideas, which are so familiar to so many of us, can you sort of just give a summary of your main ideas? That I'm thinking Catch 67 and shrinking the conflict, and what October the 7th did to those ideas in your mind.
Okay, so I'm not hanging tight to any idea I had before October 7th. Okay. I'm re-examining everything. Let's have a conversation. I want to share with you the inner logic of the ideas I had before October 7th. And I lost some of my certainty ever since October 7th.
Right.
So the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is in the foreseeable future, in the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years, in the foreseeable future, it's an unsolvable conflict. That's very hard for people to accept. Western people especially like to see conflicts as problems. And if it's a problem, logically, it has a solution. The question is, what is the solution? And we're arguing about what the solution is, but the assumption is that it has a solution.
Right.
I'm not sure this conflict has a solution, but the fact that this conflict doesn't have a solution does not mean we neglect it and stop thinking about it. That was my main critique in Catch 67, that we're living in a false dichotomy between two camps. One camp says this problem has a solution, and the solution is to completely transform reality radically. Maybe we'll go into it. And the other camp said, well, that won't solve the problem. It might even only amplify the problem. So if this is a problem without a solution, let's stop thinking about it. We have nothing to do about it. And let's just keep things the way they are.
Right. Now, if I interrupt you just really briefly. So the two sides, you're talking about the people who are pro two-state solution, which would be a radical transformation of the reality on the ground, and the people on the right who say, that's never going to work. We're never going to solve this. Let's just carry on. Is that roughly correct?
I would say the terms right and left are very, there's a lot. These words are very, very flexible. So I want to use different words, okay? The idea that you could solve the conflict and the idea that you could manage the conflict. Solve the conflict almost always means two-state solution that magically, by a withdrawal of Israel from Judea, Samaria, West Bank, or choose your term, by that withdrawal, so we'll have peace, prosperity, two nation states living side by side with peace and harmony. That was one thought. That is a radical transformation of the status quo. And many Israelis, most Israelis, that think that that is impossible in the foreseeable future. So their attitude was, well, if we can't solve it, so now we can ignore it. And ignore the conflict actually means just keeping things the way they are, freezing the status quo, and just, you know, and what's called managing the conflict. Now, my thinking was, and to some extent still is, but we might go into that, is that this is a false dichotomy because we don't think this way about any problem in our lives. Like, for example, car accidents. I hope no one's going to offer a radical idea to end car accidents. But if somebody offers a radical plan to completely end car accidents or to end crime, okay, or anything like that, usually when you try to create absolute solutions to problems, so what you do is by trying to end a problem, you're probably replacing it with a new problem. For example, if the government will try to completely eliminate crime, zero crime, the chances are that the government itself will promote certain crimes against humanity. So it's very
Or with cars, if you try to eliminate car accidents, you have to replace cars with bicycles, and everyone slowed down, and society grinds to a halt.
Exactly, and then right. Society, and then the economy is destroyed. So by trying to end the problem, usually you're replacing it with a different problem. That's usually what happens. So on the other hand, but let's say someone has a plan to completely end crime, and the critique would be, well, you can't end crime. That's impossible. It's not realistic. So what's the alternative? Ignore crime.
Right.
Just keep the way they are. Let's keep doing what we're doing. Now, obviously, it's a false dichotomy because when you think about crime, nobody wants to end crime, but the alternative to ending crime is not ignoring crime. What we try to do is shrink the amount of crime. When we think about car accidents, what we try to do is we don't try to end car accidents and we don't ignore car accidents. We try to shrink the amount of car accidents. My idea was that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict should be normalized, meaning not normalization. I mean, the problem should be treated like a normal problem. Where you don't, we're careful, pragmatic people, don't try to end it, but the alternative to ending it is not ignoring it. It's about shrinking it. So that's the framework. Now, if we want to go deeper into this framework, what do we mean when we say shrinking the conflict? So, and I want to be very, very honest here. I'm thinking here as an Israeli. I'm an Israeli writer. I'm an Israeli patriot. I'm an Israeli thinker. And I'm thinking about this not from a Kantian, objective, universal perspective. I'm thinking about this from an Israeli perspective. Mm-hmm. Now, not ignoring other perspectives, that wouldn't be smart. But my perspective, and I'm aware of that, is an Israeli perspective. And from an Israeli perspective, when you think about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, So the Israeli-Palestinian conflict presents not one, but two threats on Israel. One threat is, you know, terrorism, you know, post October 7th, it's, you know, we understand how serious the problem is. But and the other threat is the fact that there are in Judea, Samaria, the West Bank, 1.28 million Palestinians. And we can see a scenario where those Palestinians transform their national battle. Their national battle until today is that at least Fatah, or not Hamas, Fatah, at least what they say is that their battle, they want to liberate themselves from Israel. What happens if they transform their battle? Instead of trying to liberate themselves from Israel, they'll want to integrate into Israel, be a part of Israel. If that happens, it didn't happen yet, but if that happens, Israel's in deep trouble. One state solution.
Right.
Now, if that happens, Israel's in deep trouble because 1.8 million Palestinians asking to be citizens of the country that is effectively controlling some chunks of their lives, that would present a serious challenge to Israel. And they would be in a horrible, that would threaten the solid, massive Jewish majority that Israel has in Israel. Now, the precondition for Israel to be a Jewish democracy, that only works a Jewish democracy if Jews are a massive majority. Because if we're not a massive majority anymore, it can't be a Jewish democracy. It could be either Jewish or democracy, but not a Jewish democracy. So I would say if the Palestinian national movement would transform its goals, instead of liberation from Israel, integration into Israel, we would be in serious, that would be a serious problem. So these are two threats. Threat number one, their threat is terrorism. I would say that's a threat to Israelis. Mm-hmm. A threat to Israelis. Israelis are shot and bombed, you know, Israelis could be hurt. The second threat, the threat not of terrorism, but of integration, doesn't threaten Israelis. It threatens Israel as a Jewish democracy. And here's the catch. The right understands something and the left understands something. If Israel leaves Judea, Samaria, the West Bank, so the Palestinians will be able to threaten Israelis very easily. Because if anybody understands the geography of Israel, we understand that Israel is built the following way. Israel is wide in the north. It's wide in the south. When I say wide, I mean in Israeli.
Relatively wide.
Relatively wide. But paradoxically, Israel is narrow in the middle, in the center. I mean, narrow between the borders pre-1967, what we call the Green Line. It's very, very narrow. It's a little bit more than 12 miles, they think. But you're Brits, right? We can speak in kilometers, right?
Well, we prefer miles, so miles.
We prefer miles. So I think it's roughly, I'm thinking kilometers, so maybe I'm not translating correctly, but it's like roughly 12 miles. Now, here's a problem. Between the Green Line and the Mediterranean, roughly 12 miles, and that is where most Israelis live. So here's the paradox of Israeli geography, where the largest center of Israeli population is where Israel is most narrow. Now, just think about it. In October 7th and the horrible, sadistic surprise attack of Hamas, they managed to invade and for 24 hours to conquer roughly 10 miles. Imagine they would October 7th us from West Bank, Judea, Samaria, from the Green Line. They would literally capture the heart of Israel and the largest and most dense the largest concentration of Jews in the world. So you can understand why, if we leave Judea and Samaria, many Israelis, myself included, would feel like Israelis are under serious, serious threats.
I mean, look, I need to pause here just to clarify that point, because one of the reasons why Hamas was able to take over so much territory is that this territory is very sparsely populated and there wasn't much resistance. There weren't many people there, right? So, I mean, it's not a direct comparison, but your point still stands that you need a bigger terrorist force to take over the center of Israel, but it's still, you know, giving that West Bank territory to a Palestinian state that might become a representative of an Iranian output would still
make it very vulnerable. Imagine. You, in order to protect that territory from between the Green Line and the Mediterranean, you would have to have army bases and tanks within Israeli population. It would become a military.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous, right? It would become a military base.
Right.
Now, so, and this is why majority of Israelis feel like that if Israel, you see, in 2005, Israel left Gaza. And as a result, the envelope of Gaza is under constant threat of missiles. This is pre-October 7th. Yeah. Of missiles. There's roughly 50,000 Israelis living in the envelope of Gaza, and their life was constantly terrorized by missiles. Well, in the envelope of the West Bank of Judea and Samaria, there's not 50,000 Israelis, there's 5.5 million Israelis. Mm-hmm. So we create a pilot in 2005. The pilot failed. Why we want to repeat that in Judea, Samaria, West Bank, after it failed in Gaza? So this is why people on the right are very, very afraid of a withdrawal from West Bank or Judea and Samaria. But here's the problem. If we stay in Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, we're in control of 1.8 million Palestinians, which eventually want to integrate into Israel, become citizens of Israel. And then Israel's solid, massive Jewish majority would be threatened, and our identity as a Jewish democracy would be undermined. This is the catch. Here's the catch. If we leave the West Bank, our security would be risked. If we stay in Judea and Samaria, our demography would be at risk. So that's the catch, not catch 22, catch 67. What is shrinking the conflict? It's the following question. Is there a way out of this catch? Is there a way to protect our majority without threatening our security? That's the question. It seems like there is, but in order to do that, we have to give up the dream of ending the conflict. Because to end the conflict, now I don't think it's even possible to reach an agreement of a two-state solution, but let's say, hypothetically, what would a two-state solution look like? Two-state solution is not land for peace. It's 48 for 67. What does that mean? Palestinians give up their dreams of return of the refugees into Israel, the refugees that were created in 1948. They give up their dreams of 1948. They give up return of refugees. And we give up the land that we captured, conquered, liberated, choose your terminology, in 1967.
Although, if you don't mind me just interrupting briefly, that the idea of the return of the refugees, I mean, the number of actual refugees who were living then, who were not one of the 700,000 who were rejected, you know, who left when Israel was created, the number of those who are still alive is tiny. But according to the UN's special calculations that only applies to Palestinians, it's expanded magically to 5 million or something.
Because it goes 5 to 7 million, and Palestinians, that's their demand. They want between 5 to 7 million Palestinians to return. Okay, so which the way us Israelis understand that, we are asking not one thing, two things. You want a state on Judea, Samaria, and Gaza on like 67, and you want return of refugees to 48, you're asking for two states. One Palestinian state in Judea, Samaria, and Gaza in the territories. A second Palestinian state within the Green Line borders because you'll become, so that's a two-state solution, and two Palestinian state solution. So Israelis would never agree. No Israeli would agree to that. The only compromise that's possible is you give up 48, we give up 67, you give up return of refugees, we give up all the land. That is the hypothetical deal, which was never achieved. And there were so many attempts to achieve this deal, and it was never achieved. I won't go now throughout the entire history, but this was never achieved. And in different versions, Israel offered this deal to Palestinians, and it was rejected again and again and again. And by the way, I'm not blaming the Palestinians for rejecting this. I actually could understand their sense of loyalty to the refugees and their sense of loyalty to what they to the disaster that they experienced in 1948. And for Palestinians, from a Palestinian perspective, to give up Haq al-Awda, to give up right of return, is to give up a piece of their identity. Because for them, what they call the Nakba, the disaster of 48, is not something that happened to them, it's who they are. Reporters that went into refugee camps in southern Lebanon asking children to draw their homes, they didn't draw their homes in Ain el-Khin, or in Sabra and Shatila, they draw their homes in Akko, Yafa, and Haifa, and West Jerusalem. And in Tel Aviv. So I understand the Palestinian position. I understand that they don't want to give up. It's not forgetting what happened in 48 in order to get independence within the borders of 67. I understand that because the deal that was always offered to them should actually be formulated the following way. You give up your identity and you will achieve national liberty. It's identity for liberty from the Palestinian perspective. And I respect their patriotism and I respect the fact they rejected that. And that's why I do not deny the fact that this offer was always rejected. It's right. Westerners that always think that in the end, Palestinians will give up right of return. And I think that's projection. Western people, their national identity is more weak and they think about, but we should actually listen to our Palestinians. They actually, for them, Haq al-Awda, the right of return, is a real solid thing for them. And they're not going to turn their back to their past, and they're not going to turn their back to what they see as between 5 to 7 million refugees. They have solidarity. They have identity. It's a big deal for them. I'm not blaming for them for saying no. I'm just recognizing that they always said no.
Right.
And, okay, I'm just recognizing that. We have to be honest about that. Now, if somebody believes that one day there'll be a Palestinian Nelson Mandela that will give up 48 for 67, and not only will he be willing to do that, but he'll be willing to sweep the nation, to completely transform their national and historical narrative, okay, maybe one day that will happen and that would challenge us. But now let's be realistic. That's not happening. But the fact that that's not happening and the fact that there's no real two-state solution on the horizon, does that mean that now we ignore the conflict, the fact that we can't solve it, we just ignore it, which means just managing the conflict means keeping things the way they are? I think that's the wrong way to think about it, because while Israel can't solve this conflict, what we have to be thinking is not about how to end this conflict, but how to make this conflict in a way that it can't turn into an existential threat. For Israel, again, I'm admitting I am an Israeli. I'm thinking about this. I'm trying to understand the Palestinian perspective, but I'm trying to promote the Israeli national security interests. So if we leave West Bank or Judea and Samaria, our security is at risk. But if we stay there and control their lives, our majority is at risk.
Right.
So the way out of CAT 67 is once we give up the dream of solving the conflict, could look like this. We have to start building a Palestinian political entity and autonomy, which is, I would say, if we try to quantify sovereignty or autonomy and statehood is, I'm just making this up, is 100 points. Can we create a political entity that enjoys, let's say, 86 points of independence, which means they have enough authority and power to govern themselves, but not enough to threaten Israel? Like, to increase their amount of independence, the amount of self-governance, to a level where they have what Giora Island, an Israeli ex-general, calls critical mass of self-governance, that level where they can govern themselves by themselves, but they don't have enough power to threaten Israel. That would be now, since not one Palestinian, because the Palestinians never accepted a state, right, as part of a solution, they'll definitely not accept an autonomy as a part of a solution. So here's my thing. So let's just do it without a solution. Let's amplify Palestinian self-governance without asking Palestinians to give up right of return. Let's amplify Palestinian self-governance without asking them to give up their dreams to return to every inch of Israel or Palestine, whatever they want to call it. And while we give up the grand, so they said no to a state, obviously they'll say no to an autonomy. So let's not make it as a part of a grand end of conflict deal. How do you amplify Palestinian autonomy? Well, right now, Palestinian autonomy in West Bank, Judea, and Samaria, I'm using both terms because different audiences have the different sensitivities, and I don't care so much about the terminology, but listeners always do. Right now, the Palestinian autonomy that we have in West Bank, Judea, and Samaria is divided into, I think, over 150 autonomous islands, which are not connected to each other. That's one problem. The second problem is the amount of authorities that they have there are not enough. They can't really import and export by themselves what they need. They need the Israelis to say to. So they don't have enough. They're not connected.
Yeah.
There's no contiguity, and there's not enough authority. Now, shrinking the conflict means, can we turn this political entity to an entity that's connected to itself and has enough authority to govern itself? But the Israeli military stays there not because we love being there, but just because we need to be there in order to protect Tel Aviv, to protect our civilians, right? To be there as minimum as we can. And that's why it's not a state. By the way, if they want it, I don't care how they call it, but if there is a military presence there, it's not really a state. It's a autonomy on steroids. It's as close as they can get. And if anybody asks, but why would the Palestinians accept this? You see, they don't have to accept this. They don't have to give anything. They don't have to give up right of return, like their dreams about Jerusalem, their dreams about, no, it's just a move where by not, the fact that we're not ending the conflict enables us to create a reality on the ground where, on the one hand, Israel is not governing the day-to-day lives of Palestinians. So we're not controlling their lives, but because that's not a full fledged state. They're not threatening our lives. That's the sweet spot where we're not controlling them and they're not threatening us. There's no, it's all messy. There's no clean way to get there. We can, but by increasing the amount of Palestinian autonomy, we could get to a level where almost every aspect of their life, they're governing themselves, but they don't have enough power to threaten our lives. And that's where I think something that critical mass majority of Israelis could agree on. October 7th is changing some things.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to say. So these are all ideas that you've explored in depth over the past few years with and attracted great attention. The last time we met actually was a few years ago, which was when Naftali Bennett was a million years ago, when Naftali Bennett was the prime minister, and you were quite close to him, and he took on a lot of these ideas, didn't he? In not just in the way that he addressed the Palestinians, but also his own government, shrinking the conflict to enable this broad coalition. Since then, we've had the Netanyahu coming back to power. We've had October the 7th. Yeah. And I wonder what the ideas that you've just been expressing, how they have survived contact with the Israeli political reality and the Hamas attack, plus the complication of the international community led by the Americans becoming increasingly muscular in threatening to impose some kind of two-state solution, as if you can create the only Arab democracy in the world by commanding it to exist.
Okay, so there's a lot of problems here. First of all, shrinking the conflict suffers from a misunderstanding. And the misunderstanding is that it's always understood the following way, that shrinking the conflict is not about increasing self-governance, it's about increasing quality of life. Now, it's not that I'm against increasing quality of life of Palestinians. I am for increasing. Why not? Of course. But I had never had an illusion that by increasing their quality of life, so their fantasies about ending Israel, like of a Muslim fundamentalist of ending Israel, would be shaped by any way by a better quality of life. I don't believe that. I think that they are real ideologues, and that for them, the end of Israel has nothing to do with their quality of life. But because that's so, I thought increasing their level of self-governance is good for Israel because it limits their ability to integrate into Israel. I think it's Israel's interest. Increasing their quality of life comes with that, and that's a good thing. It's a moral thing. It's a Jewish thing. It's a Zionist thing. It's something that we should do because it's the right thing. But I don't think it would shrink their motivation to injure Israel.
Right. I mean, the Hamas leaders are rich enough. Their quality of life is pretty extraordinary in Qatar. They still want to kill Israelis.
But I want to share with you a problem that shrinking the conflict has right now, a very serious problem in Israel shrinking the conflict. Because of that misunderstanding, and because it's understood that shrinking the conflict, this is the wrong, I never said this, it's the wrong way to understand it, that by increasing their quality of life, their motivation to hurt Israelis will go down. So people thought that Bennett and later Netanyahu was implementing shrinking the conflict ideas by letting Palestinian workers from Gaza come to Israel, work in Israel, and bring money into Gaza, and Qatari money fleeing into Gaza. And people misunderstood that as shrinking the conflict. And now, after October 7th, people saying, oh, we tried to increase our quality of life, implementing the shrinking the conflict paradigm, and look what happened. So right now, shrinking the conflict as an idea, it's having a hard time in Israel because of the misunderstanding that shrinking the conflict is in some way an attempt to shape the intentions of our enemies by creating better quality of life. Now, if you've intervened in the past,
bribing them.
Yeah, which is something that as Zev Jabotinsky back in the 1920s said, that you can't ever transform the intentions of your enemies by. You can bribe individuals, you cannot bribe nations.
Right.
And I'm in some way also a disciple of Jabotinsky. I never thought you could bribe the Palestinian people. I want to increase the self-governance because I don't want them to integrate into Israel. But I never thought that would shrink their willingness to attack Israel. Our military has to be there. because I don't think we should trust the intentions of the Islamists.
In fact, it sort of links back to what you were saying earlier about their identity being associated with returning to Israel. If you say to a people, we'll give you all this money, this quality of life, in exchange, you're going to give up your national pride, your sense of self, your identity, and your perception of your history and your drive. Is that a deal? No one's going to take that deal.
No one's going to take that. So now, here's the problem. After, I want to share with you, though, the blind spot that I had pre-October 7th. The blind spot I had was that in Cat 67, in articles I wrote, and in, you mentioned the Mifleget HaMachshavot, Party of Ideas, the podcast that me and Efrat Shapiro Rosenberg have, we did a whole season about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And we tried to articulate and to think out loud about all the dilemmas the Israeli-Palestinian conflict creates in 30 different episodes. And I'm very embarrassed to say, we didn't have one episode about Gaza.
Wow.
And I'm asking myself after October 7th, and by the way, in my book, Cash 67, there's not one chapter about Gaza.
Wow.
Now, when I'm honest with myself, how did I ignore Gaza? I think it's because I thought that Netanyahu's paradigm regarding Gaza works.
Right. So you're talking about the concept. Explain to listeners what the concept.
Okay. Was. So I think this was, the way I understand Netanyahu's concept, and I'm sad to say I was part of the group thinking. This is, for me, very troubling, the fact that I always see myself as I'm a free thinker. My mind is not trapped in group thinking. And then you wake up after October 7th. Actually, it took me a few weeks to understand this because I was in shock for the first few weeks. I was like, oh my God. I was just a part, like that blind spot, because I thought Gaza is taken care of. So we don't have to think about it. West Bank, Judea and Samaria, that's where the trouble is. Iran is the trouble. Hezbollah is the trouble. Gaza is managed. So let me try to explain the concept here. The concept. This is how I understand it. Hamas and Gaza, Hamas can be contained. And the way to contain it is by carrying a very, very big stick and some kind of a carrot, whatever. And the big stick is the following. Every few years, Hamas will attack us. And Hamas, let me try to explain first why I ignored Hamas. Then I'll explain Netanyahu. First, I'll explain myself. Since topographically, Gaza is not on the hills that can threaten the center of Israel, it doesn't present a security risk.
Right.
I mean, there is a security risk, but it's not an existential security risk. It threatens 50,000 Israelis, which is horrible, but they don't threaten the center of Israel. So it's not an existential. This is what I thought. I was wrong.
Israelis, but not Israel. Israelis.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And because Israel left Gaza in 2005, they can't integrate into Israel. So they can't present an existential security risk. They can't threaten Israel on a security level, and they can't risk Israel on a demographic level. So the catch doesn't exist in Gaza. It's a pain. It's a problem. But it's manageable, okay? That's me pre-October 7th. I got it wrong. It turns out that, I mean, here's, I think, part of the logic that I didn't see. What happened in October 7th? There's many theories. Here's one theory. You know, throughout the past 9 months between October and January, us Israelis, we weren't behaving. We were spiraling into cold civil war. And we were misbehaving and we were highly polarized. And we were assuming the worst about each other and then hating each other because of what, all those assumptions. A book of mine is coming out about this issue in towards the end of March.
Do you mean the political crisis that led up until October the 7th?
Yes, the judicial reform, the whole, you know, and
which led to October, yeah.
And that, it began as an argument and it turned into a fight and it led to what some people thought like is a cold civil war. And our fight made us weak. And that weakness was detected by our enemies. Our enemies in Tehran, our enemies in Beirut, our enemies in Gaza, it was detected. They were observing this and they were excited about this. In 2015, Khamenei, the leader of Iran, made a prediction that by 2040, Israel will cease to exist. But the content of his prediction, it will cease to exist because it will collapse from within. And this is, by the way, in dialogue with different speech by Hassan Nasrallah in Beinspiel in 2000, where he said that Israel will collapse from within. I'm thinking in Hebrew, like Israel is like a cobweb society. I hope I'm translating correctly. I mean, spoke in Arabic. I'm thinking in Hebrew, trying to translate. So they have this theory that Israel is going to collapse from within. And in 2023, when we started fighting, they were like, it's happening.
This is it.
Our predictions are becoming a reality. Our messianic prophecies, they're a reality. And they got very excited. And according to the Israeli intelligence, now this is already leaked to Chaim Levinson from Haaretz, the Israeli intelligence noticed that there's a dilemma between our enemies. Maybe they are becoming weak, and it's a good idea for us to take advantage of their weakness and to attack them. That was one position. The more conservative position, and Iran is very conservative, is that's not a good idea. Because if we attack them, they'll unite. Why should we ruin all the good news? Let them continue spiraling into civil war. Why not? But the fact that it's already become public that, by the way, there's a term we use in Hebrew, Tamnuna Irani, the Iranian octopus. Do you use that in English?
That's Natali Bennett's idea, wasn't it? That you have to hit the head of the octopus rather than the tentacles.
So but the metaphor of the octopus, you have that in Britain also. So within the octopus, they were having this dilemma and they were saying, we should attack them, but they were thinking about it. Here's what I think happened. And this is a theory I have. It's a little bit backed, but it's a speculation. Hamas was noticing that in Hezbollah and in Iran, they're getting excited and they're debating if to attack us or not, and they decided not to. So Hamas was like, maybe if we attack, it will activate the octopus. They'll join us. So this is what we all missed. Regular logic is that the stronger part of the octopus, Iran, Hezbollah, will activate the weaker parts, Hamas. The strong activates the weak. Hamas tried to turn the whole thing upside down. It thought the weak could activate the strong, and by the way, it almost worked, and it might work. So the fact that Hamas, instead of Hamas being activated by Hezbollah and Iran, it will try to activate Hezbollah and Iran, that reverse logic, that's something I didn't see, and that's something the Israeli intelligence didn't see. And that means that Gaza, Hamas, does present a strategic threat on Israel's existence. And that was a massive blind spot. I didn't see that.
And Netanyahu didn't see that.
Netanyahu didn't see that. No one saw that. Netanyahu thought we should keep the eye on the ball on Iran.
Because his concept, the conceptia, was to keep Gaza contained and sealed, allow them to do what they want. You know, the Israeli economy has doubled in the time that Hamas has been in power or existed. So exactly. We, with our development, we create Abraham Accords, peace deals with the Arab world, we normalize, and Hamas will eventually eat itself in Gaza. So as long as we keep the fence up, and that's where the problem was.
Yeah, so there's so many failures of thinking here, but here's one of them. And I think the only way to understand the conceptia, the idea that misled us, is to understand the inner logic of it. And the inner logic of the conceptia is the following, that I started saying this before, that every few years when Hamas will attack us, we'll hit him very hard. And that's the big stick. And when they don't, there's the carrot, you know, workers and Qatari money and all this. It's embarrassing now, but that's what we thought, okay? And as a result, they're going to be like, as a result, we'll have large periods of quiet, of shik in Hebrew, of quiet time. And the idea is every time they attack us, we hit it very hard, and they'll be so terrified. In Hebrew, you say muvta. They'll be so terrified. And I think in English, you say deterrent.
Deterrent, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That they'll be so deterrent and so terrified that the next time they'll have the guts to attack us, we'll gain more time of quietness. And what happens when there's a large period where it's quiet? Here's what happens in Israel. Israelis are creative. Israelis have initiative. Israelis built a startup nation. Foreign investments come into Israel. Our economy blooms. And when our economy blooms, we have more ideas and more money, which is invested in the military. And the military is stronger. So next time Hamas attacks us, it needs even a stronger army, which creates even more deterrence. And then we have a larger period of quiet time, which enables our economy to grow more and to create a stronger army. So the conceptia, the way I understand it, was that time is on our side.
Yeah.
Was that we need to create large periods of quiet time in order for our economy to bloom so our army can get even stronger. Now, Jake, this made sense, right? This makes sense.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is the idea that failed was a smart idea, was that made sense. That's why it managed to sweep the entire system. And I thought this was a smart idea. I admit, I thought this was a smart idea. Here's what we didn't see, is that while our economy is growing and we're having better technology for our weapons and whatever, Hamas is digging. And it turns out that Hamas, Rabbi Jonathan Zaks has a great category. There's two types of evil. There's egoistic evil and there's altruistic evil. Egoistic evil is I'm willing to hurt you in order for good things to happen to me. Like if I'll steal your wallet, that's bad for you, but it's good for me. It's not that I want bad things to happen to you, I just want good things to happen to me. That's egoistic evil. Altruistic evil is like the Nazis in 1942. When they had to choose if to put weapons on trains to bring to the soldiers in the Eastern Front or to put Jews in the same train and send them to Treblinka, they chose many times the Jews, which means they were willing to injure themselves in order to kill Jews. Now that's altruistic evil. That's pure evil. When you're not hurting someone for your own benefit, but you're hurting yourself in order to be cruel to someone else. Now, I think we all assume that it's embarrassing to say that Hamas, they're evil, but it's egoistic evil. Because in the end, if they have to choose between our death or their life, they'll choose their life. That's what we assumed.
Right.
Whoever planned October 7th, which was supported by the majority of residents of Gaza, whoever planned this knew that this will happen, right? That Gaza will look this way. But when they have to choose between our life and their death, they have to choose between our death and their life, they chose our death over their life. And by the way, it wasn't a one time. It wasn't just on October 7th. If you think about it, and this is what I didn't see this. Like, I don't know how I didn't see this. They took all the investments they got from the international community, and instead of building the top part of Gaza, they invested all that money in the underground of Gaza, which literally means instead of investing in their life, in the top part of Gaza, they invested all their resources in our death, in Israel's death, meaning in the tunnels, in the underground of Gaza. So this was their strength. So this is something that's very hard for us to comprehend. And it's something that was very hard for us to see because people could only see what they experienced within themselves. And Israelis have, and when I see somebody robbing a bank, I get it. I never robbed a bank in my life, but he wants money. He wants a better life for himself. I can understand that brand of evil. But somebody that destroy his own life just so someone else would suffer, that's kind of evil that Israelis have a hard time. They don't find it in themselves. And therefore, it's a hard time to imagine that within someone else's. And that failure of imagination is the basis for the failure of our intelligence community and just regular intellectual like myself to see that Hamas is actually a strategic threat. Gaza is a strategic threat. It's not a pain. When I was thinking, it can't threaten Tel Aviv, it can't integrate into Israel, all the demographic threat, the security threat does not apply to Gaza, got it wrong.
Yeah, so, got it wrong. So Israelis underestimated the depravity, the depth of the depravity of Hamas.
Yes.
And so we have only about 10 minutes left. I just wanted to, taking stock of where we are now, we've looked at your ideas before, we've looked at what happened and how your ideas are still, they're still there. They haven't been discredited, but they've been complicated and they've changed. Do you have any idea, and given that there's so much pressure from the international community to form a two-state solution out of this Palestinian territory that is authoritarian, anti-democratic and corrupted at best, and supportive of terror, even on the West Bank? I mean, do you have any sense of a way forward that could beneficially be put into action to bring us to some kind of better future?
Well, I'm not afraid of the P word, Palestinian state. I'm not afraid of it. If we can imagine a Palestinian state that gives up right of return, that recognizes Israel's existence, and that offers complete civilian liberty and rights to Christians, to the LGBT community, to secular Palestinians, meaning if they would become a liberal democracy.
Meaning if they would become something that they're not, that you just want to replace them with somebody else. That's the solution.
I'm just saying, if Israel says to the international community, how can the international community say no to an Israeli demand that will accept a Palestinian state, but it has to be a state that does not violate the rights of its own civilians, and it doesn't violate the right of Israel to exist. And if that's the kind of Palestinian state that I can see being created in the next generation. But instead of Israel saying no, I think it should be more sophisticated diplomatically. It should say yes. It should say yes to something that no Western country could reject Israel's demands. Like, how can America say to Israel, no, we think it's okay that they discriminate against women and gay, like, come on, okay?
It's part of this idea of a pathway to two states.
I think if Israel speaks of a state, the kind of state that the West cannot reject, but the kind of state that any pragmatic person really knows it's not accessible, and if for those words, and by the way, if one day they'll give up right of return and recognize Israel's existence and give rights to their own civilians, and it will be like the Netherlands. So I think most Israelis will feel comfortable with that kind of a state on its border. But if the deal is that on a diplomatic level, Israel gets normalization with Saudi Arabia in cash immediately, and we're speaking about a Palestinian state, which would be once it's a liberal democracy, I think that might be a smart move for Israel on a diplomatic level. I don't think we should be afraid of the P word. I think we should be afraid of a Palestinian state reality where Muslim fundamentalists that discriminate against their own people also could shoot missiles on Tel Aviv. I think that's the reality that we should be protect ourselves from. I still think, but after saying that, I think the real steps, not declaration steps, the real steps should be how, on the one hand, Israeli intelligence and military stays on the ground so we can protect Israel's security, and on the other hand, amplify Palestinian self-governance so they can govern their lives by themselves and therefore protect Israel's majority.
But it feels to me as if the international community won't hear that. I mean, you're right that they can't say, no, let's have a state without women's rights and without gay rights. They won't be able to say that. But at the same time, I think it strikes me that there's a lot of deafness that's around to Israeli concerns. And I think that the overriding sense is these Palestinians are oppressed. They've been treated unfairly. They deserve their own state. That's where it begins. And that's where it ends. In fact, it begins with a declaration of a Palestinian state before any kind, even the borders are drawn, because before he's even demilitarized, before any security concerns are addressed. It strikes me that people just turn a deaf ear and just push on.
There's a growing gap between the Israeli sentiment and the international sentiment. There's a growing gap, and it's going to be a problem because Israelis left Gaza in 2005 under the assumption that you could leave territory and stay protected from that territory. And that assumption was shattered on October 7th. And now the international community is saying, oh, we're sorry that we pressured you to leave Gaza in 2005. That's not what it's saying. It's saying you should leave also the territory in Judea and Samaria, the West Bank. So that's, for Israelis, it's very weird. I think Israel should be smart about this. We should be flexible and smart. We should be savvy. We should be just like I think our generals are very creative on the battlefield. We have to be also very creative on the international level. I think this is something that Netanyahu of 2009 and 2012 knew how to do. But Netanyahu, that's in this government, can't really do. These are other problems that we have in Israel. But you're right. But the truth is, Jake, that the fact the international community is, I have a hard time believing that the international community will actually ask Israel to create an independent Palestinian state tomorrow morning. And if they will, Israel will reject it if there's something. But if the international community needs a declaration in order to, in service of a larger deal with Saudi Arabia, and it's a declaration that the international, that's in line with the values of Western people, and what's in line with the values of the Western people is also in line with the values of Israeli anxiety, because we all know that that kind of a Palestinian state is a state that won't be created tomorrow morning, and it will be created, it won't be a threat to Israel. I think there is room here for a maneuver. I just hope that we have the flexibility and the creativity to pull this off. Winston Churchill, when he spoke about the war has one aim, and that is victory. And I think he says in that great speech that if there is no victory, there is no survival. That's how most Israelis feel. Yeah. If there is no victory, there is no survival. And I think if Hamas is destroyed and we have normalization with Saudi Arabia, we're strong versus Iran, that would be victory. And if the way to victory goes through some declarations which cannot be implemented tomorrow morning and create a threat in Israel, I would be open to that. And I think many Israelis will be. But they'll be very, very suspicious. Israelis are very suspicious after October 7th. You know, I don't think there's every Israeli after October 7th is locking their doors. Everybody's like, the levels of anxiety is high, level of suspicion is high. And yet, in these conditions, we have to pull off the impossible. This has to have the right ending, has to have a good ending. And yes, and we need the support of the Jewish community, the international community, to understand not to live in a fantasy world, to live in the real world, and to understand how can we transform is a big word, but to rearrange the Middle East, and reorganize the Middle East so it will be more safe for nation states to thrive, right, including the Jewish nation state.
And that's maybe something that Jewish listeners and non-Jewish listeners, and simply, you know, people who share our worldview can help with, to try to persuade people the liberalization of the Palestinian society, of de-radicalization, is essential for before any kind of any Palestinian state. And a true desire for a state is a desire for the de-radicalization of Palestinian society. Mika, thank you so much for your time. I look forward to seeing you at Jewish Book Week, I hope, on the 10th of March. Until then, kol hakavod, carry on what you're doing. We're sending you love and support from here in Britain.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. See you soon.
You've been listening to the Israel War Briefing from the Jewish Chronicle with me, Jake Wallace-Simons. Join us next time for more insight and analysis from leading experts.